polishing off some Halloween candy.
Oh, okay. Have you, do you have a lot of candy?
No. No, this is the end of it.
You've only got the one kid.
Like, right. Exactly. So it's like mostly just stuff we bought to give away.
Yeah.
To visiting children.
Sure.
And we didn't have enough trick-or-treaters, so Dustin gets Reese's.
So we have four kids. So we have so much candy in the house that it lasts all year. And like for whatever desserts or, you know, so like by the time Halloween rolls around, we just kind of toss out the old stock. Like we turn it over
and flip it.
Yeah. Cause we have to take all the peanut stuff out for Noah. So we have to like distribute that among the other kids. And so we have to give him some of their stuff as like the airport exchange currency.
Yes.
But Noah has braces this year, so he also can't eat a bunch of like sticky candy. He can't have Starburst. So Noah basically got all of the regular M&Ms and like regular chocolate bars and stuff.
Yep.
But he mostly just can't have anything. He can't have peanuts, but he can't have anything that messes up his braces. So he doesn't get much.
Yeah.
Thankfully, he doesn't. Well, he often doesn't finish his dinner, so he also earns not that much. So it all works out. There you see, homeostasis. It all works out.
That's it.
Yeah. Well, that works. Dustin, hello.
What's up?
I don't know when this episode's coming out, but it is certainly well past Halloween.
Yes.
But we were busy, and during Halloween, and really all of November, and so we never got to talk about horror movies. Really?
Yeah.
I mean, we talked about Psycho, but like we didn't get to like talk about stuff, you know, post Halloween and newer stuff. Right,
sure.
So
yeah, exactly.
So we're going to gobbledygook a few of them tonight into this episode. So
let's do it.
Yeah. Okay. Why don't we start with Cobweb, as it is the newest of these?
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. Yeah.
It's okay, it was just a bad dream. I heard it again.
No more nightmares tonight. Okay, champ?
Daddy!
This is getting ridiculous.
This is an old house. There's bound to be bumps in the night. Peter drew this?
Yes.
Is he all right? Peter has an overactive imagination. No more nightmares.
No more.
That's right.
You know, I wish I had someone I could talk to about the things that were happening in my house.
Mom?
Decisions to protect your family.
What is that? The banging.
Enough! 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 You don't hear anything, Peter.
You have a beautiful imagination.
It's going to get you into trouble one day.
So, Cobweb...
that's a cool horror movie name.
It's a great horror movie name. And the poster's great. A lot of great decisions here. Except the one really bad one was that this opened the same weekend as Oppenheimer and Barbie.
Oh, no.
So it got the most buried any movie has ever been.
What studio is this? This is Lionsgate.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yep. So that was a bad move right there.
Those guys, all the blood of Lionsgate went to the John Wick.
Exactly. So Cobweb is directed by Samuel Bodden and written by Chris Thomas Devlin. I don't know either of these people. I think they're both fairly new people.
Those two both sound like Harry Potter characters. Like they would have a shop in Nocturne Alley.
Yes.
Bodden and Devon. Owned by the famous wizarding cousins Samuel Bodden and Christopher Thomas Devlin.
Devlin.
Of House Slytherin.
That's very true. And it stars Anthony Starr and Lizzie Kaplan.
And another Harry Potterish sounding name to actress in here, Cleopatra Coleman.
Cleopatra Come Coleman. On.
That just, you know, prefect of Potter. Hufflepuff. Yeah.
Yes.
Come on.
Cleopatra Coleman's a Hufflepuff. That's for sure.
Yeah. Cleopatra Coleman. I saw Cleopatra Coleman drawing a picture of a basilisk. And as you know, that is outlawed.
It's outlawed only on Tuesdays.
I promise I won't make this joke anymore. I'm sorry. Three times I've denied you, Dustin, your review.
That's fair. So this film is a little complicated. The general premise is your protagonist here is a little boy named Peter. And Peter, his parents are played by Lizzie Kaplan and Anthony Starr. Is it Anthony? It's Anthony, isn't it?
Anthony, it looks like.
Anthony
yeah.
Starr. So they are his parents. And what starts is like a pretty normal thing. Like, you know, the kid hears bumps in the walls and goes to tell mom and dad, slowly begins to unravel. And you realize that mom and dad may not be the nicest people in the world. And his teacher, played by Cleopatra Coleman, kind of takes an interest in him because he's drawing some kind of disturbing pictures at school. And she begins to suspect the parents are abusive and whatnot. And what unfolds is the story of it's that classic story of things bumping in the walls. And then they begin to talk to the little boy. And this voice, this girl's voice in the wall, begins to kind of, I would say poison his mind, but I don't think that's quite right. I think she's just influencing him. And over the course of the film, she influences him to do some things that are out of character for him, which of course draws the suspicion of the teacher even more. And the ire of his parents. And so what unfolds is things that go bump in the night, spooky story that is actually really good until it's kind of not. And I think that's pretty indicative of a lot of horror movies these days. But like with this one, it's really smart. And then it just falls into the trap of like, now the end has to be a big, you know, like a big thing, and it's got to be really spooky and scary. And you kind of lose what actually made it spooky and scary, which is like that these parents might be really evil to their child, right. Which is way scarier to me than a goblin and ghoul and goopst and whatever. It's like,
yeah, the human element of horror is always scarier to us than.
Yeah, for
whatever
sure.
supernatural thing is supposed to represent something else.
Well, right. And that's sort of the thing is like you begin to feel like, or at least I did, thinking about the film analytically, that maybe the thing, this voice is not real. It's not there. It's some sort of manifestation that the child is, you know, using to cope, or maybe it's like, you know, his inner voice that's kind of driving him to act out now that, you know, he's, you know, a certain age or whatever the case may be. But it just becomes that the monster is a monster and there's really nothing more to it than that. But for the first two thirds of the film, there kind of was more to it than that. And maybe it was implied. And maybe a lot of that was in my mind of like, you know, my mind filling in the spaces where there was not information. And then once that information was revealed, it was inherently just less scary than what my mind could have conjured. Cobweb is not a bad film. And in fact, Lizzie Kaplan and Anthony Starr deliver some really great performances here. And it is, like I said, it is a very good movie until it isn't. And so I think, your mileage will vary, you know, how much you enjoy a ghost to goblin demon story. But for me, I thought it was way more scary when everything was ambiguous and the parents were just generally creepy. And the idea of what they could be doing to their child was way scarier than any revelation they could have had spoon fed me. And so, it's a good movie. I mean, I do still recommend it if you have some time to kill and you want to watch something that's kind of spooky. It's not a bad way to spend some time, but it's certainly not going to stay with you in the way that like The Babadook does. Right. It's not going to stay with you in the way that, you know, any of our favorite horror films have. It's just kind of like on the better side of average. And, you know, that's kind of the best thing I can say about it.
Yeah, I remember like the scariest, one of the scariest scenes in The Babadook is when you think the mother's going to hurt her son.
Yes. Yeah.
Like it's,
for sure.
She's just yelling at him. And it's like, well, this could happen in any movie, but
right.
It's the scariest part of the horror movie.
Well, and it's so much more heightened when you know you're watching a horror movie too, because you're like, oh, this could legitimately be a bloodbath in like 2 seconds.
Yeah. And it's not just implied that she's going to hurt him. I might have to like watch this happen because this is a horror film.
It. Yeah. Exactly.
I might have to witness this.
Exactly. And it's sort of the same here. It's this idea of, you know, the parents are initially like they're fine, but you think maybe they're just really, like maybe they're extreme helicopter parents, or they're just a little bit overprotective, or maybe they're some kind of like, you know, super religious, you know, something like
right.
you never really quite can put your finger on it. And it's that ambiguity that really sells the creepiness of it. And cause you just don't know what they're capable of. And then when it slowly gets revealed what they are capable of, it starts really scary. Like, yeah. Oh, they might be capable of something really bad. And then as the film goes, it's like the mystique of that gets completely thrown out the window. Like that enigmatic, you know, thing that you can't put your finger on. That's just like unsettling in the, you know, back of your neck. But like, it's weird, man. It's kind of case in point for the old adage in horror movies that like the more you show, the less scary it is. And I think that's, I abide by that. Like, I think that's 100% true. I think that the more you can imply and the more that you can allow your audience to use their active imagination, the scarier it's going to be, because that taps into like all the ghost stories we heard as children, where it's just like you're around a campfire and you tell this ghost story and your mind is conjuring all of the images of it.
Yeah.
If a film can do that same sort of thing, you know, the go-to that everyone always points out is Jaws, right? It was technical limitations, budgetary limitations, why we're not going to show that shark all the time, but it was also for effect. That the less we see of the shark, the scarier the shark is, because A, it could be anywhere, and B, it could be any size. It could, you know, have 8 arms dangling from its teeth. Like you have no idea. And that what your brain can conjure is way scarier than what they can give you. Because once you see it, the mystery's gone. And I think this is like case in point, this film, of just imply it. It's way scarier that way. And I think had the film gone all the way with that, this could have been one of my favorite horror movies, because it just starts so strong. And it's such a really good looking movie. Like if you watch this trailer, you will see some really inventive shots. You'll see some great cinematography. And it's just a shame that eventually the story just kind of gets dumb. and I mean, yeah, I mean, that's just how it goes. But again, I don't know, maybe you're the type of person that would be really wigged out by what this becomes. I'm not. So it didn't do anything for me. It may be way better for you watching this, dear listener. But for me, I checked out in the last act. So that's Cobweb. It's streaming on Hulu. So if you really want, you know, to settle in with something that's good till it's not, there you go.
We'll take this bridge of a child character into mm-hmm. into my film. How about that?
Okay, go for it.
I want to talk about Dr. Sleep.
Okay.
When I was a kid, there was a place. A dark place. They closed it down and let it rot. But the things that lived there. They come back. Not many ride the bus this far north. You're running away from something? I'm running away from myself, I guess.
Hi. You can hear me. You're magic. Like me.
I don't know about magic. I always called it the Shining. The world is a hungry place. A dangerous place.
These people, they hurt people like us.
These empty devils, they'll eat what shines. And they noticed that little girl.
Wow. Hi there.
Get out of my head! Get out!
I haven't felt power like that in so long.
They're coming. Where are we going?
There's a place.
I'm ready.
Yes, you run, dear. And then I will find you. And you will scream for years.
Come play with us forever and ever.
Okay, so Dr. Sleep, I finally got around to watching it. This was the 2019 film directed by Mike Flanagan. Written and directed by Mike Flanagan, actually, and it's based on the novel by Stephen King, Dr. Sleep, which is the sequel to The Shining. So Danny Torrance is Ewan McGregor now, and he is still followed by ghosts from the Overlook. He is as a child, and then he sort of learns how to deal with them, kind of compartmentalize them basically. Mm-hmm. And, but he's like this horrible alcoholic, as an adult and, mm-hmm. you know, miserable and, traumatized and, and stuff. And then he spends like a few years as like a night nurse, basically at like a hospice ward where like he uses his shining ability to sort of help people pass on, like who are about to die. And then he, you know, does stuff. And then eventually he becomes aware of these like traveling gypsies. They're called the True Knot, and they are led by Rose the Hat, played here by Rebecca Ferguson. And they are psychic vampires. Basically they feed off of steam, which is like, what is what people release when they're afraid, when they're in pain, tortured. Mm-hmm. There's a real fucked up scene where they kidnap Jacob Tremblay, coming home from a baseball game, and they like torture him, and he's screaming and pleading, and they're just like sucking the steam in that he's letting out. Wow. And I was like, and it's, of course, Jacob Tremblay is like a really, really good actor. So it was
of course
a horrific scene, and nothing especially gruesome is happening. It's just a child's being fed upon. And it's, as soon as I saw him, I was like, oh man, they're going to kill this kid. I know they're going to kill him. I'm going to have to watch it because it's Jacob Tremblay. Jacob Tremblay doesn't sleepwalk through any roles.
This is true.
Jacob Tremblay isn't here to fuck around.
No.
Anyway.
Yeah, he's fantastic in Room. I don't know if you've ever seen Room.
I've seen Room. I saw Before I Wake, another Mike Flanagan film.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So in that film, he does sort of sleepwalk, but not through his performance.
Sure. There you go.
Yeah. He dreams things that become real in that one. And that's a creepy one. Anyway. So I liked this. All I heard about this, like in the, the time since it came out was how people were just kind of meh about it.
Sure.
But I was like, it's Mike Flanagan though. Like it can't be that, and so what does this even have on Rotten Tomatoes? It has a 78. It's still pretty high, but I liked it.
But of course it's going to be compared to The Shining, which is like everyone's favorite movie ever.
Well, a fun thing about this, so I really like the way I phrased this with my notes is makes it seem kind of ironic, but I really love telekinetic plot convenient powers.
Okay. Yeah.
I really like when it's like, hey, we're going to have like a battle in our mind across the country. And it's like, oh, we can just do that. That's cool. And I'm like, yeah, I know. It is cool though. Like, I like when you don't have to worry about it's not that you don't have to worry about what the rules are, but you don't have to go, I don't know, across the country. And it's like, bro, they have telekinesis. Are you
right?
You'd believe it within state lines.
We can't split hairs on this. Yeah.
Once this goes federal, like, that's kind of far away for telekinesis, don't you think?
I think with telekinesis, you got to be within a certain, it's like Bluetooth.
300 miles.
Got to be in range.
Maximum.
Yeah. Yes.
What do you got? A satellite helping you? What kind of satellite? Starlink? Is it a Starlink satellite? So, I don't know. I find it really fun, but really high stakes in the best way. This movie is essentially like about like a secret war that can only be fought in the mind. And that's like really ripe for movies. And it also is really ripe for keeping the stakes, again, really high, but semi-light, because most of the characters in a film are not aware of what you're even doing. And there's no way you could possibly ask for help or explain it to anybody,
Correct.
And so it's fun. It's the perfect blend of Stephen King and Mike Flanagan's material. I really like the idea of Danny Torrance as just a fucked up alcoholic, and he's someone who spends his time locking away malevolent spirits and linking up with other special people and stopping the evil spirits of the world. And so he links up with this girl, basically links up with him, can sort of feel him in a way. And, so they become like pen pals via like messages on a literal like chalkboard, like across wherever. And they just like chat for years before they even meet each other. And it's really cool that way. So there's a lot of cool stuff in here that happens. It's just satisfying to watch, like, kind of like you're watching in like an X-Men film. It's like, whoa, that was cool. How'd they do that? Like, or, oh, that's cool that his ability would mean he could do this. You're watching Danny Torrance do things that, this is, again, it's a strange sentence, but makes sense to me concerning what people who shine can do.
Yes.
And how he brings that into a new battleground here.
Sure.
The standout in the movie, a lot of people said, but Rebecca Ferguson's really, really good in the movie. She's terrific as Rose the Hat.
That's the least surprising sentence you've ever said.
Oh yeah. I love Rebecca Ferguson. Rebecca
Ferguson's really good in the movie. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is she in the movie? Yeah. Well, then she's good.
Yeah. She's terrific. A lot of people pointed out how well she did. Like how someone called it someone specifically said like this is probably the best role of her career.
Oh wow.
I was like, as Rose the Hat? Like in this? Yeah. And it's just like it's one of those roles where she's just like, it's just picture perfect. Like every little, every nonverbal thing she does, every line she speaks, her wardrobe, her characters, everything she does, you're just like, it's a really fun character for her to play.
Yeah.
She's really threatening, but she's very playful. It's really, really, really perfect for an actor like her.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed Dr. Sleep. And then Stephen King did too. Stephen King, obviously he and Mike Flanagan already have like a good relationship because he's, I mean, it was Gerald's Game. So Mike Flanagan in making the movie kind of had two things he was trying to do. Like he wanted to make a really good horror movie and he wanted to, but he wanted to honor Dr. Sleep, the book, as well as how he has a lot of love for The Shining as a film. But of course, The Shining is different than its book. And Stephen King was always pissed about that.
Yeah.
And so to do Dr. Sleep justice as a novel, you can't really make a direct sequel to The Shining because things are different.
Too different. Yeah.
But he has reverence for The Shining. So how do you take in plot elements from The Shining into a novel sequel that doesn't acknowledge The Shining's film's elements?
Yeah.
And he basically worked with Stephen King on it. And Stephen King was like, yeah, he did a good job. Like, King was critical of Kubrick's film adaptation to the point of writing and executive producing a new adaptation with the 1997 television miniseries. When the film Dr. Sleep's intended to be a direct adaptation of the 2013 sequel novel, director Mike Flanagan and Dr. Sleep still acknowledges Kubrick's The Shining in some way. It is an adaptation of the novel Dr. Sleep, which is Stephen King's sequel to his novel The Shining, but this also exists very much in the same cinematic universe that Kubrick established in his adaptation of The Shining. He explained working with all the sources, reconciling those three at times very different sources has been kind of the most challenging and thrilling part of this creatively for us. He first read the novel and then had a conversation with King to work out adapting all the sources. As part of the process, Flanagan recreated scenes from The Shining to use in flashbacks. As the same with The Shining, Flanagan also avoided the horror film trope of jump scares. And that's true. There was something that King said, but anyway. Oh, during early talks, King's two stipulations for the Dr. Sleep adaptation was that the Overlook would not be present and that the novel's ending would be retained. King initially rejected Flanagan's pitch of bringing back the Overlook as seen in Kubrick's film, but changed his mind after Flanagan pitched a scene within the hotel towards the end of the film that served as his reason to bring back the Overlook. Upon reading the script, King was so satisfied with the result that he said, "Everything that I ever disliked about the Kubrick version of The Shining is redeemed for me here."
Wow.
So it's really cool. I think it's interesting that like not only has he made a film that I just found entertaining,
sure,
that like essentially fixes that whole sore spot for Stephen King. You know, and honors and threads the needle and honors the film and the novels at the same time. That's really cool.
Yeah, so, that's awesome.
Mike Flanagan was just in town shooting his next movie with like Mark Hamill and Karen Gillan and stuff like that. So yeah, like they put up a picture at do you remember where we went bowling for a bachelor party? Eastern Shore Lanes?
Yes.
Yep, was that Eastern Shore? Hold on. Was that in Gulf Shores? No, that was the Eastern Shore Lanes. I know this is going to be hard for you to remember because you were there once.
Yeah, but I think so. Right.
Hold on. I'm sorry, everyone. This does make sense. Give me a second. I'll bring this all back. This is my ADHD. We had dinner and then we went bowling, right? That was the next thing we did.
Yeah, I think so.
And then we picked up more beer and then we did bazooka ball.
Yes.
Geographically, that makes sense. Causeway to Daphne.
I'm pretty sure. So I'm pretty sure.
They went to the same bowling alley that we did. They went to Eastern Shore Lanes and bowled like or whatever. Like I saw like Chiwetel Ejiofor there and like and awesome. In this picture. Anyway, the point being, Mike Flanagan didn't shoot this down here, but he shoots a lot of stuff over here. So we love Mike Flanagan in my area. And I love his movies. Every time I talk about one on here, I'm always pleased.
Yeah.
So
sweet.
If you never saw Dr. Sleep, I recommend it. If you're a fan of Mike Flanagan, it's a very Mike Flanagan movie. But obviously it requires a love of the Shining to enjoy.
Sure.
And, I think it does well. People think that it falls apart in the third act because there's so much, you know, there's stuff from the Shining that comes back and people are kind of like, feel like it just becomes like a rehash of the Shining. I don't think so. Personally.
Okay.
But it's not an invalid criticism.
Gotcha.
For people to say too much Shining in Dr. Sleep.
Gotcha.
Okay. I thought it was cool.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Anyway. Yeah, no, I never saw it. I think it was at one point streaming on Max. Maybe it still is.
Let's see where it is at the time of our recording, because I watched it. Right now it's on Hulu. Oh, it's on Hulu and on Max.
Okay. Okay.
I think it's probably just on Max.
Gotcha.
Let me see. I'll click on Hulu. I bet you it'll tell me I need to upgrade.
Probably. Well, yeah, no, I need to finally sit down and watch this.
Yeah. Oh, you know what? I think I rented this, to be honest.
Oh, really?
I went to the library and grabbed it.
Yeah. But yeah. Yep.
Anyway. Yeah. It bounces around, but you know, I think it's on Hulu right now.
Sweet.
Also, that's great. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Cool. Awesome. Yeah,
it's worth it.
Sweet. Dr. Sleep.
All right. So I'm not sure what the connection is. I'll find one. Let's talk about A Haunting in Venice.
Hey, okay. A Haunting in Venice.
Hercule Poirot, I've found something. I've looked at it from every which way. I am the smartest person I ever met, and I can't figure it out, so I came to the second.
You are up to something, my friend.
I've seen a million of these so-called psychics, each one a fake.
I do not believe in psychics.
Come with me to a seance. Spot the con I can't.
Detective, you are here to discredit me, but I can talk to the dead.
I'd give all I have to hear my daughter's voice.
If someone wants to be heard, we are here. Listening.
She'll leave this place until I know who did it.
A ghost killed her.
There must be a rational answer for all of this.
Just admit that you are up against something bigger than you.
No!
You were saying...
Something in this house tried to kill me.
Don't look at me like I'm a suspect. We're old friends.
Every murderer is somebody's old friend. No one shall leave until I find if the living have been killed by the dead.
You have been hiding here all this time.
Who are you talking to?
Haunting in Venice is... kind of a horror movie. I mean, not really. I mean, it kind of. It has a lot of horror movie tropey stuff in it, and it's kind of filmed like one, but it's still just a normal whodunit. So, A Haunting in Venice is the third of the Kenneth Branagh Poirot films. The first two, I was lukewarm on. I don't know why I keep watching these, other than just to say like. Oh, it's a whodunit, and maybe it'll be good.
Right.
A Haunting in Venice is ultimately, I think, kind of forgettable, which probably is one of the worst things that a whodunit can do, because you need to remember the clues, and you need to remember things, you know, that are happening. And I never felt like anything that was happening was super. Like sticking with me, even though I was like watching it. Like it wasn't on the background. I was watching it. And then I found myself like two scenes later, forgetting what like, just
wait,
happened.
What? Yeah.
Wait, hold on. And having to like go back and like do the like 30 seconds backwards a couple times. I mean, like
the thing you normally would have to do if you weren't paying attention, like, oh shit, I was looking at my phone. Sorry.
Yes.
But right there, you're like, oh shit, I was staring. Wait, I was looking at this. Wait a second. I should know this.
It was like I was watching it, and I don't know if my brain was just like thinking of other thing. Like just
when you
drifting.
Fall asleep with the wheel for a second, you're like, oh, I've driven an entire mile.
Yeah, exactly. It's that, it's my that turn. Feeling. it's not wrong. So of course this film is written, directed and starring Kenneth Branagh, as Hercule Poirot. It also stars Michelle Yeoh, Jamie Dornan, Tina Fey, and a few other people that you probably know.
Ooh, Kelly Riley.
Yeah, Kelly Riley's in this.
Folks.
And yeah, man, it's It's fine. I mean, it's 2.5 stars, so it's a little less than fine. Let me just give you a rundown of the thing. So this is after those first two Poirot films. Hercule Poirot is a little bit jaded. He's like not taking cases anymore. He's bored and he's kind of living a reclusive life. And even though people are like knocking at his door every day to help, you know, like, hey, help me solve this case, he doesn't want, like, none of them intrigue him. And he's lost the zeal for life, basically, and for the mystery and the hunt, as Holmes would call it. And then, wouldn't you know it, Tina Fey shows up at his door, and she is a mystery writer, and she's looking for a new book. And she says that there's a medium played by Michelle Yeoh who is going to be visiting Kelly Riley at her estate. And Kelly Riley's daughter had passed away, and she's hoping that she'll use Michelle Yeoh to contact her dead daughter and get some answers on who killed her, or, you know, just talk to her in general. And Tina Fey, who's kind of a skeptic, has seen Michelle Yeoh perform a few times and is actually, she can't figure out how she does it. So she wants Poirot to come with her and help her see, one, is Michelle Yeoh for real? Yeah. Or is she like, I want your eyes, Poirot, to tell me if like, what am I not seeing? Cause it looks right. real to me. Yeah. And wouldn't you know it, murder happens. And good thing Poirot's there already. And so,
why did you bring me here?
this is one of my criticisms of all of the films, is the murder happens after he's already there. And yeah. I feel like this is such a weird thing. It's not like the murder happens and then he travels to the place where the murder happens yeah. to investigate. Instead, it's like murder happens only because he's there. And then he'll like shut all the doors and be like, nobody leaves until we figure out what's going on.
I'd be like, hey, including you, dude, I've read the papers. Like, the common thread here is you.
Yeah, you're the one.
Yeah. It's the perfect cover for a serial killer. It's like, hey, no one leave. I'm an inspector who was here already, and I'm going to solve this
you're
murder.
You're the killer.
Wait a second. Wait a minute. What about you? No. It's not right. me. I said I'm the inspector.
I'm the inspector. The inspector can't be the murderer.
So I'm safe. Wait a second.
Have you seen my mustache? Do I look like a murderer? Again, it's just kind of a forgettable film. I do think that, you know, Kenneth Branagh is doing his best. I mean, he's a great actor. We all know this. As a director, I think that there's some weird stuff in this. Like, he's purposefully modeling a lot of this after the horror genre, and it works. Where he does that. But then there's also some weird editing choices, some weird music choices. And it's just some of the choices that he makes that I think are a little bit off the wall, or feel like, I don't want to say they're not my cup of tea, because that makes it feel super subjective, which, I mean, film is, but it almost feels like a mistake. You know what I mean? Like, almost amateurish in a way.
And
I don't mean that in any kind of way. I'm just saying, like for me, those choices didn't work, and it doesn't seem like it's a subjective, it doesn't work. It feels more like this is a mistake. Doesn't work. Yeah.
It's like an oversight.
Yeah, there's a moment probably around the third act, the start of the third act, where it's this tense kind of moment, and there's a lot of movement, a lot of action. People are running and people are moving. And what you'd expect is some either no music in a horror film, or music that helps drive that tension. Yeah. And instead we get this weird, like, it's almost like a jaunty, like, classical thing. And it just doesn't fit. And so it's like, okay, that's a weird choice. Like, cause it's not helping the emotion of the scene. It's just like background music, which I think is weird. And it's, in fact, it's kind of working against the emotion of the scene. And then the other thing is there's some editing choices in here that I think are really weird. And some of it might come down to like a lack of coverage, and some of it might come down to just weird stylistic, like we're going to do this thing. Like if we cut here, it's jarring and it'll be spooky, but it just doesn't work really. It's just jarring. It's not spooky. It's just jarring. And so couple that with a few, you know, not so great special or visual effects and a story, like I said, that's kind of forgettable, and you wind up with this package that's, just kind of bland and feels done quickly and cheaply, even though it's probably not cheap. I don't know how quickly it was made, but it feels like they probably got this in the can really quick. I don't know. It's just one of those weird ones. I think I'm going to have to be done with these movies. And I feel like I said this after the last one, after Death on the Nile, because Death on the Nile was nothing but like CG bullcrap and green screens. And this is much more practical, which is great, but it's also just like, it's kind of a waste of my time. So I don't know. I also think that the casts are getting progressively less impressive. Like if you go back to the Murder on the Orient Express, that's a pretty stacked cast, right?
Yeah.
Michelle Pfeiffer and Willem Dafoe and Johnny Depp was in that,
Depp. Yeah. Johnny Depp's in there.
Daisy Ridley, these people who were both like huge stars of their time. And then like Daisy Ridley's hot right now because of the Star Wars. So we're going to use Daisy Ridley. And so it's like a mixture of these things. And then with Death on the Nile, it's like you got Gal Gadot and Armie Hammer.
Mm-hmm.
That's like, oh, that didn't age well. And then with this one, Michelle Yeoh is hot right now. That's true. But the Tina Fey casting is really strange. Weird to me. It's very off the wall. And this is what I mean by some of the choices are just very strange. I have nothing against Tina Fey. I don't think she's particularly strong in this role.
No, it seems. I even when I was watching the trailer, I was like, why is Tina Fey in this?
Yeah, it's weird. Fit. Like There's a moment where she does the like scream queen thing where like a murder happens and you have to let out the scream, and it just feels so forced. And I'm like, I've never really thought about it, but like, that's probably a really difficult thing to make feel genuine.
Yeah.
And you don't really think about it because I guess people cast people who can do it. But with Tina, you know, I think she's supremely talented, but I don't think this is her forte. And so I don't think she's particularly strong here. And then, you know, there again, other than Michelle Yeoh, it feels kind of lackluster in its cast. So I don't know. If the big stacked star-studded cast isn't drawing me anymore and the story is as forgettable as always, I think I'm just going to have to be done. And that's a shame because I love a good whodunit, and that's why I keep tuning into these, but I've seen three of them now and they're not good whodunits. I do like the original Murder on the Orient Express. So there's nothing wrong with the story. Agatha Christie certainly could write a mystery, but there's just something in the execution of these films that feels dull. So, I don't know. I'll say this, you know, good for Kenneth Branagh for finding something that he can work on his directing with and continually put out something that I'm sure is really fun for him. You know, because we all know Kenneth Branagh's an incredibly talented dramatic actor and can do no wrong. I'm sure this is like a really great popcorny broad character he can play. That's probably a lot of fun for him. So good for him for finding that and sticking with it and, you know, breathing life into it behind the scenes as well. But yeah, it's just, I don't think these are for me.
It's like when I was talking about how Jon Favreau, you know, found a way to become a full-time retained employee of Lucasfilm and he's just paid to play with toys.
Like, yeah. Yep.
Kenneth Branagh figured out how to get Warner Brothers to, to pay him to star as this character he loves. All you gotta do is make movies for us to sell. And he's like, sure.
Yeah, sure. Why not?
Sure. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. And, and it almost comes across as like him saying like, these are actors I want to work with.
Right.
Rather than like, they're necessarily right for the part. Yeah. Like even Michelle Yeoh as the medium feels weird. Because to the best of my recollection, there's no mention, like her name is Joyce Reynolds and there's no mention of her being Chinese or anything. Mm-hmm. It just feels really like, I don't know. It's just weird. It's like, that could have been anybody. And I'm sure you just wanted to work with Michelle Yeoh and I don't blame you. I do too.
Right. But, and the studio's like, oh yeah, we'll sell Michelle Yeoh's name. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. But it just feels like a little bit of a waste of her and kind of, you know, what makes her special and what makes her so great is, you know, that she's able to bridge the gap between the Eastern and Western sensibilities so adeptly. It's strange to just kind of like, yeah, you're playing Joyce Reynolds. It just feels like that role was written for somebody else.
It's almost like old Hollywood in a way. It's like, it's almost like Ed Wood. It's like, hey, I met this wrestler. He's just going to be in the movie now. It's like Kenneth Branagh was just at a party and he's like, oh, you know who I met? I met Tina Fey tonight. She's real cool. I think I'll put her in a movie. Hey, I also met Michelle Yeoh. She's cool. I'll put her in a movie. Yes. Hey, good news. I cast the film.
Right.
I did it already. I just cast every single person I met at this one engagement.
At the one party. That's right.
Yeah. It's like, okay.
That's pretty much what it was. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. It also smacks a little bit of like, you know, all those Adam Sandler movies where it's just him and his friends on vacation. Sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's the same sort of thing. It's like, hey, pals, let's all go to Venice. And so they go to Venice for a little while and do this thing that feels fast and quick and cheap. And then, you know, Tina Fey gets a vacation out of it.
Sure. But at least those people feel realistic as Adam Sandler's friends because they're Adam Sandler's friends.
Yes. Right.
Tina Fey wouldn't strike me as a, you know, whatever pulp writer in the 40s or whatever this is.
Yeah.
I know that she's a writer in real life, but is that the only connection?
I guess so. It also just strikes me as funny to think that she's like hanging out with Kenneth Branagh on the weekends. You know what I mean? Like, that just feels really weird. And also the film implies there's like a really old friendship between the two of them that like goes back decades. Uh-huh. And I'm like, yeah, I'm not buying that.
What, did y'all survive the Spanish flu together?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, man, I don't know. It's not offensive, but it's also just nothing special.
Yeah. And that's its own kind of offense.
Yeah. I was going to say, sometimes that's even worse.
That's enough.
Yeah.
Make me feel something. At least movies I hate. Like I want to feel
hatred for.
Oh, I just want to feel the burn, the pain.
I want to be mad at you for what you've done to me. You made me watch this. And this one is just like, oh yeah. Like even me telling you recently that I saw this and we should talk about it. I had to remind myself, did I actually see that? Did I finish that? I was like, oh yeah, I did. That's right.
Oh, hang on. Hold on. I got to tend to one more thing. Sorry. Oliver like bit his lip earlier tonight because he was jumping on his bed and he fell so far that he hit his chin on like the frame of the bed and just bit the shit out of his lip and it still hurts. So Having a hard time going to sleep. Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
It's the only way they learn.
It's true.
Have to keep falling. So you mentioned Haunting in Venice was like quick. Just feels like it was done quickly, cheaply. Mm-hmm. Not always a bad thing. Quickly and cheaply.
No.
As I thought the case was with X.
Ah, okay.
Farmer's daughter, take one. I need to be famous, Wayne. All the best people are.
There ain't nobody else out there like you.
You know why?
Why?
Because you got that X factor. Our days of struggling may soon be over.
Hollywood, here we go.
So this is it. Our own studio backlot.
I'm looking for a place to stay.
Oh, yes, sir.
That's one ugly son of a bitch. And my wife, Pearl, is next door, so I would appreciate a little discretion.
He don't know what we're doing, does he?
Well, it's better to beg for forgiveness and ask for permission.
Would you like to come inside?
What's a box?
I want to be in the movie.
Well, you can't. The story can't just change midway through.
If Daddy catches us, there's no telling what he might do.
My wife is not well. It happens after dark.
You don't want to leave, do you?
People's eyes are gonna pop out of their damn skulls when they see this.
What? Are you all right?
No.
Boys found this inside.
What do you think is on it?
I see one goddamn fucked up horror picture.
X is written and directed by Ty West, and produced and edited by Ty West. Well, jack of all trades over here. So it came out in 2022. I think it was, yeah, March. And I believe it debuted at South by Southwest. This is an A24 film. It's a horror movie, and it is, well, it's a slasher. And it's about, it's 1979, and there's a bunch of people who go out to this farm to shoot a porno, and they're out there to make an adult film, and it's a really, it's like a, what, it's like five people. It's like, okay, the movie's got Mia Goth, Jenna Ortega, Martin Henderson, Brittany Snow, Owen Campbell. And so those five are the people, and like Mia Goth is one of the actors. Jenna Ortega is like the girlfriend of the director. She's there to like do sound. Brittany So's one of the other actors. Owen Campbell, Scott Miscuti. Hold on a second. Scott Miscuti. Kid Cudi. Is that Kid Cudi? The rapper. That guy is. That was Kid Cudi? Huh. Sorry. I'm just...
Revelations.
Well, I don't know what that guy looks like, so I
sure.
That's so strange. How... Okay. He was really good. Like, he was... I don't know. It's not always a direct transfer when, like, when rappers want to act. You know, like Ludacris and 50 Cent. Okay.
Yep.
Anyway, okay, sorry. That makes sense. All right. Sorry, that just threw me for a loop there. So they're all either in the film or working on the film, and they go out to this farm to go shoot it. And while they're out there, they're kind of threatened, antagonized by the couple, the old couple whose farm they're on. So anyway, I don't want to say too much more, but yeah, then slasher things happen.
Sure.
You know, again, I say cheaply and quickly, this was, the budget was $1 million for this movie. Made $15 million back. So it's, you know, nice little profit for them. And it did pretty well critically as well. I liked it. I didn't love it. I heard X was really good. I watched it and I was like, it's cool. It's cool. Good slasher. You know, I don't have any major complaints. Probably nicely artfully done. If you look at like the subtext of these movies, you know, it's sort of, it's, I'll talk about it more in, when I talk about Pearl, but like Ty West is trying to make a movie about something. And he's using a slasher as, you know, the medium through which to tell it. This one, I know he said he was, they have like a big conversation about like VHSs and home media and what's, you know, how that influences what studios want to make and whatever, what that did for like the porn industry and stuff. And taste being driven somewhat by availability or whatnot. That was a big reason for him to make it about people making an adult film, why it's in the late '70s. And it's just one of those things like, wow, that's one of those things that's crazy with artists. Sometimes you go like, how do you go from being interested in that like area of time and VHSs, and then it's like, how do I make a movie about that? I know, I'll make a slasher about a bunch of porn actors who get killed off. It's like, wow, I wouldn't have thought to connect those two things. It's okay, well,
sure,
it works. It's just, wow, that's so strange. I wouldn't have thought of that. I would have thought of something different, I suppose. So
sure.
So anyway, this is actually part of a film trilogy, actually, from Ty West. So the same year, actually the same time they were shooting this, they also filmed this, the prequel to this movie, Pearl.
Please, Lord, make me the biggest star the world has ever known, so that I may get far, far away from this place.
You know, caring for your family during these times is admirable. But you only get one take at this life.
If only they would just die.
Pardon?
Nothing. Peter! I want to be special. Dancing up on the screen like the pretty girls in the pictures.
I will not let you leave this farm again.
I'm worried there may be something real wrong with me.
Rumor has it they only take one gal per town.
We're looking for someone with X Factor.
It has to be me.
How about a film nobody else has seen?
Is it legal?
It will be eventually.
I know what I've done. Bad things. Terrible, awful, murderous things. I want to be loved from as many people as possible. But truth is, I'm not really a good person.
Takes place on the same farm in the past, and we meet Pearl, who is played by Mia Goth in this film, and was also played by Mia Goth in X, because Pearl is the old woman who lives there. So in X, Mia Goth is playing both this Maxine girl and Pearl, dual roles. Now in Pearl, she is playing Pearl as a young as a young girl. I loved Pearl way more than X. I thought it was, I don't know, much more my speed. I thought Mia Goth was really good in this movie. She's excellent as Pearl. Like, she's good as Maxine or whatever, but she's kind of like just a whole different vibe. And then she's an old woman in makeup in X for as Pearl. So it's like, that's a different kind of characterization. In this one, she's youthful and she's peppy and happy and toxically positive and just like really like everything picture production wise in this movie is somewhat based on like, you know, big Wizard of Oz-esque like musical optimism in a way. That's very much driving her characterization and their style somewhat. So, I mean, it's, yeah, it's 19. Oh, wow. I mentioned the Spanish flu. It's 1918 actually in this film. So the Spanish flu is part of the plot here. Mm-hmm. She lives on her Texas homestead with her German immigrant parents. Her father is infirm. He's in a wheelchair. And her mother is just having to run the whole farm and take care of the dad and take care of Pearl. And she's real sick of it. And Pearl wants to become like a chorus girl. She loves, you know, she loves movies and she's a big dreamer and wants to leave the farm and go be in show business. And, but also Pearl, it shows us some signs of sociopathy a little bit. She'll every now and then she'll kill one of the farm animals, or she'll do something abusive to her father when he can't do anything about it. Pearl's a little fucked in the head and in a situation that she's quickly boiling out of. Pearl is, I don't want to say too much more about the plot. Pearl kind of loses it. Pearl has a goal in this and she doesn't reach it. Cause you know, throughout the film, like, okay, Pearl's not going to leave Texas because she's still living there on this farm.
Sure.
In X. Right. Yeah, so happens? Well, the thing she's trying to do doesn't work out and she doesn't take it well. That's Pearl. I don't know. I just thought this one was really artfully done. Carrying over to that, note about these films being about show business and how they influence people in a way. Mm-hmm. By the way, too, like this was written and directed by Ty West, but co-written by Mia Goth. Like Mia Goth has a screenwriting co-credit on this film.
Interesting.
I almost have a feeling that like this was the first idea. But it wasn't, because it says that he began writing a script for this prequel film during production on X. So they just decided.
Well, or began writing the screenplay, but maybe had the story idea.
He stated that the prequel project had developed from a story he had collaborated on with Mia Goth, and that he had seen it either as becoming a potential film or simply serving as a backstory for her role as Pearl in the first movie. After the onset of the coronavirus pandemic and seeing its impact on the cinema industry, West stated that he had been inspired to continue working and had decided to begin production on the prequel immediately after wrapping on the previous installment. West stated that he had pitched his idea of a new franchise to A24 and had been surprised when they greenlit his projects. The filmmaker stated he intends each film to have its own distinct style and genre of horror. Describing his approach to X, he said he was heavily influenced by the Texas Chainsaw Massacre franchise and by the works of Mario Bava, which explore how the rise of independent filmmaking affected society. So it's, you know, these are a bunch of, you know, indie people making an indie project effectively.
Sure.
Regarding Pearl, he described it as a Douglas Sirk melodrama meeting the Technicolor style of Mary Poppins and the Wizard of Oz, made as a demented Disney movie, and said it will explore how Hollywood filmmaking has influenced people. West stated that he intends to continue this trend of exploring diverse styles and genres in future installments. And then the third film is supposed to be 2024, and it's titled Maxine with three X's. And Maxine is supposed to be a sequel to X.
Okay.
Because, spoiler alert, Maxine survives X.
Mm-hmm.
Mia Goth is so Maxine is now more of a sequel to the events of that film.
So
we start in the middle, we go back, and then we go to the end.
Got it.
I don't know. I think they're interesting. I think I expected to be more blown away by stuff, and I wasn't blown away by X. I enjoyed it. But I wasn't like, whoa, it wasn't like a revelation. I thought Pearl, like I said, Pearl was better. And I think this, I just think Pearl is carried really well by Mia Goth. I just think her performance is really good. She does this creepy stare at the end of the, like the final shot is her like forcing a smile. And she does it for like a full minute while the credits roll. Like Mia Goth just sits there and has to hold that smile. And there's tears start coming out of her eye. Like it's mesmerizing. Wow. And I sat there for the whole time until the circle closed on her face. I was like, I couldn't get up. I couldn't look away. I was like hypnotized. Yeah. I was like, that was so off-putting.
Yeah,
it's really interesting stuff. I don't know. I'll be checking out Maxine. I mean, wow, they've already got a cast. We got Mia Goth, Elizabeth Debicki, Michelle Monaghan, Bobby Cannavale, Lily Collins, Halsey, Giancarlo Esposito.
Hey.
And Kevin Bacon.
Hey.
Huh.
Wow. Okay.
Giancarlo Esposito as an agent for the adult film industry and Z-list film actors.
There you go.
I can't wait to see what that's like.
Right.
Would you mind putting your clothes on, please, for me? Would you mind getting dressed?
He's just Gus Fring.
Yeah.
Tightening
his tie. I don't like to be kept waiting. I don't know.
Yes.
Yeah. So
sweet.
Whatever. I'm into it, you know, and whenever filmmakers have something they're doing and it's, you know, it feels like they're doing their thing. That's cool. I like that Ty West is doing his thing. And, you know, again, these made money. I mean, X made 15 million. Pearl didn't make as much. It made 10 million, but still it made 10 times its budget back.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
I mean, they shot this in, it's not even in Texas. They shot it in New Zealand. And so Ty West was like, I mean, it wasn't lost on us that we were making a film. You know, like New Zealand was one of the only places you could like even make movies at the time.
Yep.
So I think that's part of why A24 bought it. Cause they're like, shit, someone's in New Zealand right he has an idea and he's already got everyone down there. The crew's down there. Is everyone's working? It's all ready to go. Yeah. Just do it. Whatever. I don't care. We'll do it.
Right.
It worked. Wow. It worked out. So it's that strange alchemy that makes for interesting films, you know?
Yep. Yep. Totally.
So, okay. Well, those are a bundle of horror films. So
there you go.
Yeah, I rented X and Pearl from the library as well. They're not on streaming anywhere that I could find.
Gotcha.
Okay.
Sweet.
Goodbye, everybody.
Later.
See you later.
See you later.